Hey, early call timers.
Early call time.
Welcome to a very special episode number 50.
Crazy.
I never thought that we would make it past 15.
Yeah. I didn't think even the first one would ever go live.
I've been trying to quit this thing for the last 6 months.
Really? I know. No, of course not.
So we have a very special guest today. It's director John Badham.
Wow.
What movies has he done, JJ?
Well, he's done Saturday Night Fever.
Wow. Kay.
Mm-hmm. Short Circuit.
Mm-hmm. Holy shit.
War Games.
Mm-hmm. What the fuck?
Blue Thunder.
Amazing.
What are some other ones?
A movie called Bird on the Wire. Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Which he talks about in the interview.
Stakeout.
Which he also talks about in the
interview. He's got stories for all of his
movies. He's got some Goldie Hawn stories.
Oh, that Goldie Hawn story is really
good. That's a good one. So, you know, what we're trying to say is this is a fat interview. So we have broken
in
it up.
Both senses of the word.
We went to
fat.
His house.
We yeah. did. We sat in his office.
We took pictures with the robot from Short Circuit.
We walked up and down both stairways of his house.
Yep.
Saw a big old portrait painting of him, which was really good, painted by his wife.
Yeah,
it's real nice. So this is a two-parter. Part number one is us, you know, just getting to know John, and you know, in turn, you getting to know John.
Yeah.
That is a nice way to put that.
I'm a very nice way of putting things.
Yeah.
So that's the first part, and then the second part is mainly questions, our questions, your guys' questions,
yep.
and all the leftover stuff that didn't make it into episode
one. So please don't think we're ignoring you when we don't ask any of your listener questions in the first part. We actually get to your questions in the second part because we recorded with almost 3 hours with John.
Yeah. And by second part, we mean that episode will air next week.
Right. So listen this week, listen next week.
It's a to-be-continued.
And without further ado,
listen to our intro?
Listen to the intro for John Badham.
Throughout all of history, they've only talked about the fame, never the hard work, never the elbow grease, never the early call time.
So we have JJ.
Hello.
And we have Nadav.
Hello.
We have Andrew. And we have our very special guest today, Mr. John Badham.
All right.
Thanks for being here. We're in John's house, so I guess
it's
we should.
Kind of, I'm at John's desk.
Yes, you are.
We're moving in next Thursday.
Yeah.
your words, John, not mine, right?
That's right.
Yes.
So you've got quite the career to discuss. I was hoping you could start off by just reading word for word both of your books.
That'd be okay.
That would take up a super
amount. It only took
time.
Me 3 days for one book to read.
Did it take you 3 days to do that?
It'll give you a lot of podcast.
Okay.
Great. We got a lot of hard drive space. We could do that.
Well, we're going to take off. You just read.
Was that okay. John Badham on directing?
Yes.
Yes. It's a very good book, by the way.
Fantastic
thank
book.
Thank you.
Have
thank
you thought
you.
About doing the other one as an audiobook at some point? I'll be in my trailer.
It's a good idea, and I'd like to do it. Yeah, I think it would be something worth trying to arrange.
Yeah. Well, they're very inspirational.
Made books. Me want to direct.
Yes, so absolutely.
I'm normally an editor, and I was like, man, this is something that is achievable. Because, you know, seeing it at the editing room, you see all the things that the directors try to do and the performances that they try to get out of the actors. And I'm mm-hmm. like, yeah, I mean, it's something that's doable. And I don't know, it always thought to me like it was too much. It was like way out here, but it is actually something we could all do.
Oh. Well, it is. I do know that it certainly seemed like that to me for a long time as just this impossible mountain to climb. And that was after I had a master's degree in directing in theater. But the idea of directing film was just like, oh, my gosh, I'm looking up Everest.
Yeah.
And there was a day, three years later, where I woke up one day and said, I can do this. I now understand it enough where I feel like I could do it. I don't know how good I would have been, But I was, you know, just had the flash of confidence, and that didn't mean there wasn't a giant learning curve still coming and that still exists.
Right.
Right.
You know, that's one of the fun things about it is that every film, every situation is totally different and every challenge is different.
Right.
So it keeps you going. You're not standing on the Chevrolet assembly line, putting a wheel on every 15 seconds.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, mind-numbing kind of work. It's constantly challenging, and the actors are changing, the crew is changing, the scripts are changing, and you're trying to figure out how to get the best out of what you have, how to maximize it. And if there's ever a day when you're not terrified about what you're doing, you probably don't care anymore.
Right.
You probably have given up, and you're just sort of going through the motions, which at a certain point of skill level, it's easy to do, but it can, you know, result in, you know, boring films.
Right.
So do you think even at this point, I mean, are there still times when you're looking at a script and thinking, I have no idea how we're going to pull this off, and then you just work the problem and create solutions, or is it?
Yeah, Richard Dreyfuss told me a few years ago that he sometimes saw acting as a series of problems to be worked.
Okay.
And, you know, how am I going to make this character do this? And how am I going to make even this moment in a scene work?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, looking at it as a problem-solving thing in addition to being an artistic challenge.
Right.
So, yes, there's lots of times when something that looks so simple on the paper turns out to be a real challenge. And you wonder later, what was so hard about that? Well, it's because you're trying to make many elements come into harmony and many elements come together between cinematography, staging, the actor's problems, what the set is limiting you to do, and you're trying to somehow make all of this work together harmoniously, and it can drive you a little nuts.
Right.
but when you solve it, well, it's very satisfying and pleasing.
So you said that, you've been in the game for a long time, and you said that a lot of things have been changing. What are the biggest changes that you've seen? Like, what were the biggest problems you had when you first started compared to the biggest problems you have now where you are at?
Well, the biggest problems that we will always have are trying to get the best scripts that we can and make the most out of whatever script it is that we've decided to work on, and to get the best performances. There's been sea changes in the technology,
right,
of how we work in every single department. And, you know, all through computer revolution and digitization and so on. And even before that, the equipment getting lighter and lighter and the invention of the Steadicam and film from Kodak and Fuji and Agfa getting faster and faster and faster, meaning how the whole lighting technique changed. So there are all of these technological changes that go on continually that it's not that hard to keep up with. I mean, it's sometimes a little frustrating to keep up with it, but it's always exciting. And, okay, here's this new piece of equipment. Here's this new way of doing something. Here's a Panaflex. Oh, no, now here's a Red camera. Oh, no, now here's, you know, the Alexa. And that's all kind of fun. But at the end of the day, if you go back to an old Bolex 8mm and you shoot a really good picture with, it has a good story, that's going to take over everything.
Right.
So you have to kind of keep it in perspective that the story and the performances and storytelling are the most important things.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology is fun and gives you all kinds of possibilities that are fun. But don't ever neglect the story because it doesn't... it will jump up and bite you in the butt. You know, you think, oh, we made the first Tron, and that was like this big deal. Oh, my God, Tron. Well, they forgot to put the story in. They got very so true. Carried away with the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew it.
Yeah.
What kind of stories do you like to tell most? Like, is it something like Saturday Night Fever, more of your style?
You were pointing right at me, well, and I realized that you pointed at the poster behind me.
Or is it more science fiction in a fashion, like with Short Circuit, or?
Well, the thing that always attracts me the most to scripts, and in the case of Saturday Night Fever, in the case of Short Circuit, in the case of War Games, it was the characters that were jumping off the page at me. Number 5 in Short Circuit jumped off the page and got hold of me. And that's what drove me. I said, I really love this character. And the story supported it. The fact that it was science fiction wasn't as important.
Right.
So in all of the films that I've really enjoyed doing, it's been the characters that have attracted me the first thing. Mm-hmm. With Saturday Night Fever, I had never been in Brooklyn a day in my life. Oh. I don't think I had ever been in a disco, though I thank my mother for making me, when I was 12 years old, go to dance class, and you know, which I hated at the time.
Yeah.
And learning how to foxtrot and how to tango and how to waltz. And you go, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. But was I glad about that when I got to doing Saturday Night Fever? Because I looked at the way people were dancing and I went, well, wait a minute. The Hustle is just a foxtrot with a different beat.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on. This is just a, you know, this is just a tango kind of thing. And, and I go, oh, okay, well, this is not so hard.
Right.
You know, I have some understanding of it.
Yeah.
And, of course, I had a choreographer, a brilliant choreographer. But, you know, I didn't feel so divorced from the, you know, from the process because I understood how it worked. And there was one day where there's a crucial dance scene in the film where Travolta and the girlfriend Stephanie that he meets, it was Karen Lynn Gorney, they run into a big empty dance studio and they start doing this kind of first time they've danced together, and it becomes this fun, elaborate, kind of joyful thing. Who doesn't show up that day? My choreographer. He's not there.
Oh, boy.
And my assistant at the time had been a Balanchine dancer when she was younger. And so between the four of us, we choreographed a new dance that was like a tango, a tango hustle, we called it. And had great fun with big Travolta dipping her down to the ground where her head is, you know, on the ground, and all those kind of fancy big leg lifts and things like that. And it was really tremendous fun.
Which is also the same dance number that's in Short Circuit that Johnny Five is doing with Ally Sheedy. So
that's right. Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah. So there was a case of initial panic, and then everybody sort of focusing on how do we solve this.
Right.
And thank goodness I had Colleen there who could, you know, work with the actors, and they had enough dance experience where they pulled this off, and it was beautiful.
So it was just choreographed on the day?
Choreographed on the day.
Wow.
And our choreographer, who is long gone, Lester Wilson, had somehow taken a fashion show that day and said he never saw the call sheet, so he didn't know that he was, you know, supposed to be there.
Yeah.
you went, oh, God, well, that's Lester.
So if we can kind of go way back to how you first got started in show business, what did you always know that this is something that you wanted to do, or was it something you discovered as you were growing up, or how did that all begin?
I know. Well, my mother was an actress and was studying acting in London because she was born in England, as was I.
Mm-hmm.
And she was studying acting, and then World War II comes along, which kind of put a crimp in everybody's life. And everybody was doing some kind of war effort work.
Mm-hmm.
She was lecturing to troops and driving people around in trucks. And she described to me learning how to drive an 18-wheeler and double clutch and do all of that that stuff.
It's a good skill.
But when we moved to the United States after the war, she started acting locally, and she started a radio show in Birmingham, Alabama, and had one of the first television shows. So I know that I've got a lot of her genes in me.
Yeah.
Because I was taking an interest in all of that and started acting in school.
Okay.
And thinking, oh, acting is a lot of fun. When I got into college, I was now acting with people who were just way better than me.
Yeah.
You know, my contemporary, you know, people in the freshman class, sophomore, they were way better. And I was still having fun, but something in the back of my head said, you know, you probably shouldn't be trying to make a living at this. You know, because it's fine in college, but who knows what it's going to be like when you get out there. You know it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
And I had taken a lot of interest in directing and started to notice that was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, started to put my focus in that direction, learning to direct theater. So I went to the Yale Drama School after undergraduate school, and I went as a director.
Okay.
And was directing theater. Along about that time, while I'm, you know, your basic starving graduate student, my mother calls me from Alabama to say, guess what? Your 9-year-old sister is going to star in a movie with Gregory Peck. You go, what the? What the? Get out of town. How did this happen? And they had literally been looking for the character of Scout all over the country for mm-hmm. To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
And had stopped in Birmingham at the local theater and were seeing any actors there.
Right.
They liked my sister is the short version of the story and took her to New York and tested her. And the two kids in the movie were both from Birmingham, from that theater.
Oh. Mm.
That's really
which
cool.
Which was interesting because the book was written in Monroeville, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
and so you got very authentic kids, which by the way, when the movie was finished, the executives at Universal Pictures hated their accents and said they couldn't understand them at all.
It's too authentic.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
They were too authentic, and they wanted to ADR
mm-hmm.
all of their voices for the entire movie.
Oh, boy.
And
ADR, by the way, for some listeners, is when the audio that was recorded in the field didn't sound so well, so then they redo it in a studio.
Yeah.
Putting it out there.
ADR stands for Automated Dialogue Replacement.
Yeah.
And you go into a sound booth, and they play the original sound for you, and you try to imitate it.
Yeah.
How does that usually work out every time you've witnessed it? Does it always sound better, or is it always like throw it off?
It takes a little practice to get good at it, because the first thing you have to do is get the timing perfect.
Right.
But then there is this other thing called acting that you have to do, so you can do a perfect matching of the voice, but if you don't do the acting, it sounds as fake as, you know, like bad Italian movies.
Right? Yeah.
With bad, you know, bad sound replacement.
Are you in the, for features, are you in the booth with them when they're doing the ADR typically?
Yes, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
In a television show, they'll send the actor off and there'll be an ADR guy there who will guide them through it.
Right.
But you want to really make sure for quality control that you get it right, so it's best for the director to show up.
Right.
But that never works out on a television schedule.
No.
It's usually the AP or somebody
that's doing that.
So did they end up having to replace their dialogue?
No, they never did, because Robert Mulligan, the director, Andrew Pakula, Alan Pakula, and Gregory Peck all put their foot down and said, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
And
Gregory Peck was an extremely powerful force in Hollywood, and especially at Universal, where he had offices.
Mm-hmm.
So he just was really very strong about it.
Yeah.
And things went ahead. So meanwhile, back at the Yale Drama School and starving dog food and stuff like that, I exaggerate to make a point. I hear of all this going on, and it's exciting. The next summer, my sister got the part in a Twilight Zone episode.
Oh.
And so she came out, she and my mother came out, and I was out of school, so I came out here with them.
Mm-hmm.
And got to watch them film the whole thing and on the old MGM lot, which is now the Sony lot.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had these massive back lots that have long since been sold off, but every time you just walk down the street and you'd go from a Western set to a Chinese set, you'd be on a city street, you'd be in some kind of medieval castle. It was just endless magic. It was just completely magical walking around the old MGM lots. And the producer of the Twilight Zone was talking to me and said, "Oh, well, come on out. When you're ready, come on out and let's see. Maybe we can help find you something to do." So that's, you might as well have, guaranteed me to be, to have direct a big feature. I was so excited.
Yeah.
Oh boy. And come on out meant nothing more than come on out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had to do basic training in the Army for 6 months. This is before Vietnam. And once I finished basic training in Texas, I got in the car, came right here, went to his office and, met with him. And he said, "Oh, this is great. Just keep talking to people." And I keep thinking, where's the job?
It's like, I'm talking to you.
There's no job here. And I'm kind of standing out on the street in Culver City going, what happened? By that point, the Twilight Zone show was canceled. It had run its course.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only was I not having a job, he didn't have one either. So
okay.
I couldn't get too mad at him.
Right.
Funny how that works.
But I, did then what everybody else does, which just kept going around and interviewing and going to mailrooms and NBC Page and all these places trying to find an opening.
Mm-hmm.
NBC said, I'm sorry, we don't have room for you. You're too tall. You don't fit our uniforms. I'm only 6'1", but anyway.
That's changed. I was an NBC Page, and we had tall pages. So.
You had tall pages.
Yeah.
But
well, yeah, John over here set the precedent.
Yes, yeah. That's right. They said, we've got to, rights got to for tall it. People.
Yeah.
And I went and applied at Universal in the mailroom along with other mailrooms, and nothing. And one day, about 4 months after I got here, I think two guys in the Universal mailroom quit out of disgust and just frustration. Yeah. And so they went to the next two guys on the list.
Mm-hmm.
That was me and Mike Medavoy, who became head of United Artists.
Okay.
Subsequently, and was you know, is still a very powerful producer. Phoenix Pictures that he founded, and Orion Pictures that he founded, along with the United Artists people. So the two of us started on the same day, and him saying, I want to be a producer, and me saying, I want to be a director, and everybody just laughing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, me too, kid. Yeah, I want to be the Pope. Sure, right, I'll be Mao Zedong. That was the way it was done at that point. They stick you in the mailroom, and it was up to you to find your way out. And if you didn't find your way out in a couple of years, they would let you go. But you could go to places you were interested in. Go to the art department if that was something. You know, go to the editing, go to camera, which is what a lot of us were doing, going to different departments and, you know, looking for openings that in a field that we were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So the mailroom was almost like an internship in a fashion. You know, seeing all these different things and seeing your interests and getting
to know people, getting to know what interests you, people that you would see every day because you're just delivering mail and you acquired a certain legitimacy just like interns because you're there,
right?
And people be more willing to talk to you, and if something opened up which you didn't know, maybe it would be all right. Right around that point, the Directors Guild was starting its training program. Before that, the way you got to be an assistant director was your father was an assistant director, and it was completely complete nepotism, and you know, or some big executive, you know, twisted somebody's arm to make you a trainee. So they founded a training program, and my friend Walter Hill and I both went and applied to the training program and went through the interviews and the tests and stuff, and accepted both of us. And Walter went on to the training program, and right around that point, I got a job as a casting trainee in casting, and I was really thrown about what to do about it. And I opted to go with the casting because people kept telling me that if you were an assistant director, that's where you were going to be stuck for the rest of your life. And the same thing could have been said about casting, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could say that about whatever your first job was.
Whatever it is. But anyway, that's the way I went. And it did give me the opportunity to work with lots of really, really wonderful directors in television, and who made lots of features subsequently, like Michael Ritchie was a very good friend of mine. And so I was able to go to the sets and watch them work and you know, have good conversations as we were casting their pictures. And I also got to work with the actors and learn the agents and, you know, learning all the actors as you're auditioning them and getting them ready. So all this was good experience, and good experience for working with actors. And so an opportunity came up with one producer that I was working with. As I said earlier, there was that day when I woke up and said, I can do this. I know how to do this. And producer Bill Sackheim, that I was working for at that point, had made a pilot about a suicide hotline. And this was for ABC. And ABC wanted a short presentation to kind of explain to people in a few words what the series was about, something about 3 or 4 minutes long. And I went into Bill's office and I said, can I direct this little presentation? And God bless him, he never blinked an eye. He just went, sure.
Go right ahead.
And
that's great.
And so in the in the little presentation, I had the director, who was Jerry Thorpe, and the star of it was Vince Edwards, who had been Dr. Ben Casey, and another wonderful actor, Clu Gulager. And so we got to shoot in the Universal projection rooms where, in our little presentation, the three guys had been watching the pilot, and then comes up, the light comes up, and Clu Gulager has to ask the duh question of, gee, Vince, what a great show. What's the pilot? What's the series going to be about? Well, it's going to be, well, this and that and da-da. And they get up and they walk through the projection building and down some stairs, and you know, we just staged this big walk and talk scene that, you know, explained everything. And that actually got put together, sent to ABC like the next day, finished. But the finished product also got me my first episode of television to direct.
Oh, wow. There it is.
That another producer, David Levinson, who was another friend, had seen this and said, here, you come and direct this series that we're doing with Hal Holbrook called The Senator. Mm-hmm. And it was a brand new series. They were going to make 8 episodes of it, and I could do one of the 8.
Okay.
Which is great. I mean, I couldn't believe my good fortune. And
how terrified were you?
Really scared. I mean, I was on the set for I was doing like episode 7. So I was also the associate producer on the show. So I was on the set every day watching, learning, and, you know, trying to, you know, get caught up. So I got a good relationship with the cameraman and the crew and everybody. So by the time I started directing, I had a lot of people who were, you know, I was friends with and who were rooting for me and willing to help. And,
sure.
And that helped a lot. But as I say, I was pretty terrified.
Mm-hmm.
But here, many years later, I'm still terrified to go to work. You know, for Stitchers, I'm driving out to Santa Clarita at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning going, oh, my God, oh, my God. Oh, I hope I can make this work.
Oh, yeah, that's actually how we know John. He directed an episode of Stitchers, which is a show that Andrew works on.
That premieres tonight, by the way.
Oh.
9 p.m. on ABC Family.
All right, guys. Watch it.
Yeah, you had some interesting stuff to shoot there that's, you know, it's an episode that airs later on, but there's some fun, you know, elevator sequences and climbing through things and spy action-y stuff. Yeah.
This episode, every episode, you hope, has some challenges in it that are fun.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular episode is one that every show will make at least one of. And they call it a bottle show,
mm-hmm.
because the entire show is usually confined to one or two sets that already exist.
Right.
And make no bones about it, it's a cost-saving measure.
Yeah.
Say, well, we had to spend all this money on these other shows. Let's do one inexpensively.
Yeah.
And we'll keep it all in one place, and we'll just have our regular cast in it, and this will keep the cost down. Well, the history of bottle shows is they usually cost more than other shows.
How does that end up happening?
Because everybody tries to make them really exciting and interesting, and next thing you know, they add a little of this and a little of that. And
helicopter crashes. And
yeah, I mean, you know, suddenly we're adding in elevator shafts that have to be built and tunnels to be crawled through and this, that, and the next thing. But it certainly is a great example of, you know, fun challenges. How do you take this very small elevator shaft that's only 12 feet tall and try to make it look like it's 200 yards tall?
Right.
And thank God for CGI and things like that, because we can do so many things that you never could have done 10, 15 years ago on a television budget.
Mm-hmm.
You could have done it for a long time on a film budget, but CGI was so expensive for television, it's only recently that it's gotten where it's affordable, and you can really do a lot of magical things.
Yeah.
That maybe the average viewer may not even notice, you know, transparent kind of things, like mm-hmm. making an elevator shaft look really long. And if you've done your job right, it shouldn't look like you did anything.
Right.
It should just look like, oh, yeah, it's a wow. Where did they find that elevator shaft?
Well, I know JJ edits on Scorpion, and mm-hmm. he was showing me an episode of with a forest fire and some helicopter shots flying around with all this fire. He was saying, all right, guess which of these shots is completely CGI? And the whole thing looks totally real to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew my mind when it was,
well, that, and
said, this is totally false.
It's, and I feel like background replacement as well. Like, for example, if you're shooting here in LA and you need it to look like San Francisco, they can put a green screen up now, and they can put a plate of a San Francisco screen.
Yeah, the Golden yeah. Gate Bridge behind you.
Yeah. It's seamless. It's not, you can't tell.
Well, I know our initial pilot for Stitchers was set in New York. And so they would shoot downtown, and then they would just throw the Empire State Building in the background somewhere, and boom, now we're in New York City. And, you know, it's interesting.
Instead of flying the whole crew out there.
Yeah.
Which,
but you, John, you work a lot in, not in LA. I mean, you're kind of all over the place, right?
Well, yes, I've been working a lot in Canada for many years because that's where the work is.
Yeah.
So much of it in Toronto and Vancouver.
Yeah.
And then last summer I was in Atlanta for Constantine that was shooting there.
Oh, nice. My buddy, I think, worked on that as well.
Oh, good. Who's that?
Matthew Levine.
Okay.
I think he was probably in the writer's room. I think that's where he was working.
Okay. All cool right. Stuff. Well, the writers were all world. Here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is a style of production that is kind of hard, where the writers are in one country or one state, and the movie or the episode is being produced in another long way away. And usually all the post-production is where the writers are.
Right.
So there's a lot of shipping back and forth. And one of the nice things about the show Stitchers is everything is at Santa Clarita.
Yeah.
The editors are right there. The actors are right there. The writers are right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you only have to walk 50 yards one direction or another to get to the department. And this makes for much more efficient kind of production, certainly a lot less expensive than flying people all over hell and gone.
Yeah,
right.
I like going to Canada. I love Vancouver. It's a wonderful city. Toronto is too, and I've shot in Calgary and Newfoundland and lots of the provinces there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've also shot in about 30 of the United States too.
Wow.
Over time, it's amazing how it kind of builds up.
Yeah. Do you notice? I mean, what are some of the differences versus working in television and features?
Well, the biggest difference is aside from cost, which is pretty obvious, is the time you have to do something.
Right.
Here we're talking about Stitchers. That's a show, an hour show. That's done in 7 days, and you'll come out with 42 minutes of picture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say the average movie is 110 minutes or so, an hour 50, you know, just under 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the shooting schedule on that will be, just for a regular movie, not a big special effects movie, but it might be 50 days. So the same amount of screen time on a television show would be 15, 16 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you need to get a lot done.
So that means that for a television show, you're trying to jam a lot into very little time, get a lot of stuff done.
Yeah.
In a film, you have time to get the lighting right, get the coverage you want, get the, you know, make big location moves that might be impossible otherwise,
mm-hmm.
and take a lot more care because it's going on a much bigger screen. and needs to last a lot longer.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to say it, episodes of television are sometimes, you feel like they're a little bit disposable. You know, if this episode doesn't work, people have kind of forgotten about it
mm-hmm.
in a couple of days, and you go on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, with On Demand, nothing is totally forgettable. It's,
yeah.
it's there forever.
Right.
Yeah.
And you don't have to just go to Channel 56 in Orange County to find the old episodes.
Yeah.
You know, they're all there.
Right.
But people will forgive a director or an actor or a writer for a television episode that doesn't work too well,
mm-hmm.
whereas the movie will haunt you forever.
Yeah.
Right. Much bigger budget, right?
Yeah, bigger budget. It didn't do the box office. It was a flop. It was this. And so television works differently from that. But at the same time, the director's position in television is very different from in features where...
Yeah.
In a feature, the director will be pretty much in charge. Once you get past the budget and the casting,
mm-hmm.
They're pretty much in control of everything. A television series is like a franchise. It's like Transformers or Terminator or Star Wars or anything like that. And it has to be watched over and protected and taken care of. And you can't have a director coming in who wants to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
You've got to have a director who says, okay, I can work within these parameters.
Mm-hmm.
I can direct within these parameters. I will try to bring something new to the party. I will try new things, but the new things have to be... You know, just a little outside the envelope.
Yeah,
you can't go way out into outer space.
Yeah.
With it, and the producers are really in charge of the television episodes. They're the ones that have the control, and they're the ones that you have to listen to,
mm-hmm.
and they have the final say. I mean, there is no such thing as a television director having final cut.
Yeah.
Unless he's the producer of the show,
right?
And then that would be of course a different situation.
Of course, even then you have the network that's got to weigh in and the studio and.
Oh yes, absolutely. It's very Kafkaesque.
Yeah.
You think that you're talking to the writer of the show, but beyond the writer, there's the executive producer. Then there's the studio, and then there's the network, and. In that hierarchy, each one of them has their say.
Yeah.
And depending on how strong the producer is and how much cachet they have, they're either having to knuckle under to the network or, you know, telling them what to do with their ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen both, you know, with a powerful producer like Stephen Bochco, NYPD Blue and so many great series, he basically would tell the network, no, we're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we are going to say this. And yes, we are going to have some partial nudity. And I don't care.
and, we'll pay the fines.
He was able to have a say. A producer who doesn't have that status finds themselves knuckling under because they fear their show will be canceled.
Right.
And, oh, my God, he won't do what we tell him, so, well, forget that show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there should be some kind of a balance in between producers-wise? I mean, you have Bochco, and then you have someone that is worried about their show being canceled. Is there a happy medium where everyone's happy? And
well, it's so much personnel-driven. I mean, that mm-hmm. sounds kind of dry. But so much of what we do is so dependent on the people who are doing it and different personalities. So if you have, a very compliant human being who wants to give you the best show possible and listen to everything, you work with him because he's talented.
Mm-hmm.
You can also have a very difficult producer who's, you know, maybe a little on the nuts side.
Right.
That is a pain to work with, but gives you wonderful, wonderful things. And some networks and cable channels are much more understanding and forgiving than others.
Right.
HBO is an example of somebody that's very understanding and very much looking to push the envelope and expand ideas and try things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they've become kind of the leader in what we can do with new ideas and encouraging Amazon and Netflix and these other places to try things that your network, NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, are the main ones, and I guess the CW too,
mm-hmm.
they are so controlled by their advertisers. Right. And the advertisers want a certain kind of watcher. They don't want a show that has a lot of elderly people in it, because elderly people don't go out and buy stuff. They want they'd love to have everybody who's in their teens and 20s, because they're always going out and buying stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of thinking that is judging their programming choices.
Mm-hmm.
And they're operating out of fear. I was talking about Comcast. Above the networks come the advertisers.
Right.
And once they start withdrawing their advertising, the networks are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And they're paying a lot for these shows because they cost a lot to produce.
Yeah.
So they go, okay, get rid of that show. Okay, that's not drawing. You know, no. Let us keep working with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we all know, you know, great examples of things that were canceled early on, like Star Trek, you know, which eked out 3 seasons, and we know what's happened to Star Trek since then.
Right.
You know, it took them 20, 25 years to bring it back.
Yeah.
And then it stayed on the air forever. I mean, some kind of
incarnation. And then suddenly all of its children started just to stay on the air. But, you know, that was coming out of a decision, well, the people aren't watching it. It's too weird. We're canceling the show. And they didn't know what kind of audience they had.
Yeah.
But that comes out of fear of the advertisers who are making your network run. The cable channels are sustaining because we're paying all those big cable bills.
Mm-hmm.
And we're paying for HBO, and we're paying for Showtime and Netflix and so on. There seem to be enough of us that can keep all of this alive.
Yeah.
And we're paying for, you know, that kind of quality program that we're getting.
So when you talk about feeling that, kind of going back a bit, when you felt that first sense of sort of fear and pressure doing your first episode of television, was it a different level of fear and pressure when you did your first feature, because this is something on a bigger scale now and there's more at stake? Or was it, were you more comfortable?
Yes, let's see. My first television show, The Senator, was shot in 6 days. And my first movie with Richard Pryor and Billy Dee Williams and James Earl Jones was called The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars.
Okay.
And it was a baseball movie. Now, it was to be shot in 38 days
mm-hmm.
and was a relatively low-budget film. And so they got a director who could shoot at television speed for a low-budget film. I think they had talked to a lot of more experienced directors, but it was going to cost them a lot more.
Right.
And Universal, you know, wasn't sure how much they could do with this movie as it was. So I looked at 38 days and I said, oh, boy, this is plenty of time. What am I going to do in the afternoon? I only have to shoot 2.5 pages a day? Oh, my gosh, this is so easy.
That's a dream to edit 2.5 pages a day. Man.
Yeah. I mean, you go, wow. What I hadn't thought of and didn't occur to me till I got out there that with a baseball film, baseball game, the simplest thing becomes an inordinate amount of setups.
Mm-hmm.
Guy steps up to the plate, knocks a little grounder to the short, who throws it to second base and then to first for a double play. I just did 9 setups. In order to tell that story, you've got to, you know, be on all of those people. You've got to get wide shots. You've got to see the ball passing back and forth. You're going to be on the pitcher, the catcher, the umpire, the shortstop, second baseman, first baseman, and the runner. And you're just, oh, my gosh, this is just taking forever.
Yeah.
So our 38 days became 52 days.
Okay.
With much grumbling from Universal for their $4 million picture.
When they thought that they could get a TV director to do it
yeah,
faster.
And we were going as fast as we could. And we had 2 and often 3 cameras going.
Mm-hmm.
With Panavision equipment. It just takes time.
Yeah.
And Saturday Night Fever was almost the identical situation. Mm-hmm. 38 days that became 52 days because nobody understood how long it would take to film dance.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Least of all myself.
Right.
You know, you forget that there's a physical element in, say, baseball or dance or horse racing,
mm-hmm.
where the people doing it or the horses running it, they get tired.
Yeah.
You know, you can only do so much with them.
Right.
We were in Georgia in the middle of July, which is no place to be.
Yeah.
Outside on a ballpark in a bright, glaring day every day.
Yeah.
With our African American baseball players,
yeah.
There's a really great story in your book, John Badham Under Acting.
Mm-hmm.
It was something about ad libbing with the actors. There was some kind of like line that had to be said, and you were like, well, we can just write something, and then the actors were like, no, we can ad lib something, and. Am I not making any sense? It was an interesting
story.
This was on that picture. Yeah.
And now we have a picture which is about the Negro baseball leagues, as they mm-hmm. were called at the time, that couldn't play with white players. This is before Jackie Robinson and any kind of integration took place. And it's been written by a white Chicago journalist, the novel,
mm-hmm.
The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars. It's been screenplayed by Matt Robbins and Hal Barwood, 2 white writers,
okay.
being produced by Rob Cohen. That doesn't sound African-American. And John Badham from Birmingham, Alabama, home of racism, and Bull Connor. So
he's dying over there.
So we're now all these little white boys, you know, telling these black guys what's black, you know, and what's not. So we get into a scene where the dialogue seems to be uncomfortable and not working, and I am a great believer in having actors, you know, improvise and, you know, add to dialogue and make up stuff. You know, if it doesn't work, it's fine. We don't have to use it.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful freeing thing as an actor to know that if you have an idea that you can say it and you won't get yelled at.
Right.
And in this particular case, the dialogue we had was pretty stiff and not really working, and the actors said, no, we know how to do this. It was a group of baseball players in the middle of the game trashing one another,
mm-hmm.
you know, and and saying all yo mama kind of jokes.
Yeah.
And yo mama's so fat that, you know, all of those kind yeah. of things. She have to sneak up on a glass of water. She was so ugly. So, you know, I let them just get going on that and just start doing their own stuff. And And it made for a wonderful scene, something that would have been kind of flat and boring.
Yeah.
And it was very funny because that kind of doing the dozens, as it was called at the time, mm-hmm. you know, was a terrific way for people to, you know, goof around with each other and insult in a funny way.
Yeah. Well, if you've got somebody like Richard Pryor, who's obviously one of the funniest guys to have ever lived, who can...
I'm sure he could roast his friends.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I think he's good at that.
Yeah, he could be wicked, wickedly funny. You know, there was always something kind and sweet about Richard, even though he'd be angry and pissed off about something in the world. There was something that was so vulnerable about him that you just went with it and you kind of forgave him and loved him, even though you knew he was, very troubled in a lot of ways.
Was that, what point in his career was that? Was he kind of, was he really up there or was this still?
No, he had gotten an Academy Award nomination for Lady Sings the Blues, which really put him on the map, as a comedian, and an actor that you could watch.
Yeah,
that was a big deal. He'd been in a couple of movies, and he had a gold record. When I went to his house, I remember seeing a gold record framed on the wall. It might have been platinum record.
Well, you've got gold records up there too.
I do, from Saturday Night Fever.
All right.
The difference is with mine. Is there's only one hole in the center of my record.
Okay.
With Richard, there was two holes in the middle of his record. And I go, Richard, why are there two holes in the middle of this record? He goes, I got mad at it and I shot it one day.
All right. We've done some other quite notable movies. I know JJ had a question about Short Circuit.
Hold on. I
mean, several. A number of.
But ones. Before we move on to another movie, I kind of wanted to address something that you said before. So you were given 30-something days to shoot those two features, and you ended up going over. Like, were there any consequences to that? Did you just get, like, a good talking to? Or, because, I mean, they gave you another one right after, right? They gave you Saturday Night Fever.
No, they didn't give me one right after, even though that probably started about 8 months after Bingo Long was announced, was released.
Okay.
Before I got to that. I think that the studio realized that we were all doing the absolute best that we could, and they were into it deep enough. You know, that they could tell that we weren't messing around, we weren't taking too much time, there wasn't any, you know, bad behavior or ridiculous stuff, and we were deep enough into it where they didn't feel like they had to replace the director, which I think would have been the first line of defense.
Right.
Well, no, the first line of defense was, as you say, a good talking to.
Right.
And, you know, putting the pressure on. And that they were doing, and I was, appropriately motivated. I was appropriately motivated the whole time. But it just was way harder than anybody thought. So they could see that the end was coming. It was not like it was going to be a money pit like Jaws became, the first Jaws, which they thought was going to be relatively easy to do, and nobody had counted on what working in the open ocean would be like. And that movie basically succeeded in finishing production because became as good as it was because Spielberg was as tough-minded in production as anybody could possibly be. Somebody who was less strong-willed might have caved and started shooting crappy shots, and Steven would just sit out there and say, no, we'll wait till the shark is ready, because it was the shark that was always giving him trouble.
Yeah.
and things now that we would think nothing of, like, oh, it's summer and Martha's Vineyard. We're shooting just off Martha's Vineyard, and there's 1,000 boats out there sailing around, little people out having their summer sail.
Mm-hmm.
We can't control the ocean, you know? So they'd say, okay, we have to turn the ship around and put the shark over here, and you turn the ship around, put the shark over there, and now the light had changed. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, the shark didn't work. As I say, it's only because he was very strong-willed that it got done, but the budget doubled in the process, and it went from 50 days to 100 days. The original schedule was 50 days.
That math checks out.
And everything they did on land, and this is almost the same with Saturday Night Fever, everything I did in the streets and apartments and everything was spot on schedule.
Uh-huh.
And you know, my Waterloo was the disco, and his his was the ocean with the shark.
Yeah.
Right.
Because when you're in a battle with the ocean always wins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just
I've
no contest.
Storm.
It's a good lesson.
Yeah.
So I think I got off okay with that, and people liked the movie. And when the opportunity came along to do Saturday Night Fever, that was, still a 38-day schedule.
Right. They're like, all right, John, no funny business this time. Yeah.
And again, I'm naive enough to think, okay, well, we can do this in 38. But my production manager is saying, oh, I think it's going to be 52. And I go, yeah, but we told them we could do it in 38. And it was supposed to be like a $2 million picture.
Mm-hmm.
With a cast that was all beginners, and a director is basically a beginner, and even with 5 years of television and one other movie, you know, relatively unknown. But the disco just took more days, and couldn't be helped.
Right.
It's okay because the picture, you know, worldwide rentals were over $300 million. And you can't complain for a $4 million picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. So that was part number one of the John Badham interview.
Fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah. Fan-fucking-tastic.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
Super.
So... listen to
part two
next week for part two with John Badham.
It's going to have your listener questions.
Listener questions.
We got quite a few of them.
The remaining short circuit questions that I had.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Kind of nerd out.
That's fine.
I apologize.
No, that's totally fine.
And we should mention, this was John Badham's first podcast ever.
Ever.
We broke his podcast cherry.
And he did a great job, I think.
I think so, too.
I think he's got a future in doing our podcast.
He's a natural. And with that being said, listen next week and listen to the outro.
And that's a wrap. Didn't get your fill at Craft Services and you want more? Check out earlycalltime.com for more podcasts and information pertaining to the ever-growing entertainment industry. And remember to tell your friends about us via Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.